Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Hausman, an assistant professor of history at the University of St. Thomas, and your host for today's interview. I'm speaking with Mark Santiago, director of the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and the author of A Bad Peace and a Good War, Spain and the Mescalero Apache Uprising of 1795 to 1799, which came out with the University of Oklahoma Press in 2018, and in 2019, won the Robert M. Utley Award for the Best Military History of the Frontier and West from the Western History Association. Welcome to the New Books Network, Mark.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
So I always like to begin my interviews by just hearing a bit about the guests themselves. So can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, about your background, about how you became interested in history, and about your current work as a museum director?
Well, first of all, as I said, I just retired at the end of July. So I'm a former museum director at this point right now.
Gotcha.
I retired from the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum. I had always been interested in history as a child growing up. It's what I majored in. And I got a bachelor's and master's degree in history. And I went into the museum field. At the time, they called it applied history. They call it museum studies now. But I went into history and to museums, and I got a job with the Arizona Historical Society. And I worked there in Yuma and in Tucson. And later in the Phoenix area. And then I got a job later in my career with the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs, first at the Space History Museum in Alamogordo, and then later at the Farm and Ranch Museum here in Las Cruces. And I had about 36 years of museum experience. And in that time, being a museum guy, especially when I was younger at the Arizona Historical Society, they had a wonderful collection of both Spanish colonial artifacts and Native American, especially Apache artifacts. And I became interested in the subject of Spain and especially Spain's relationships with various Apache peoples. I was fortunate in 1994 to be able to do an exhibit on a guy named Hugo O'Connor, who was an Irishman who fought for the Spanish here in this area. And that led to my first book. You write one book and you get interested in other things. And so I've written about four books now. This is my fourth book, and maybe a dozen or so articles, mostly on the Spanish military in the borderlands region in the 18th century.
Can you tell us a little bit also about the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum? I've never been there, but it sounds like a fascinating place.
Well, it is. It's wonderful. It's a part of the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs, state organization. Cultural Affairs has about 15 divisions, and most of those are museums. And we are a museum in Las Cruces, which is in the southern part of New Mexico. And the museum details the 4,000-year-old fascinating history of agriculture in New Mexico. Again, history the agriculture goes back to about 2,500 BC or so, all the way up to the present. And the museum is quite interesting in that not only do we have a traditional museum building with traditional museum exhibits, but we also have a working cattle ranch. We have mainly beef cattle, but we have some dairy cattle, as well as horses and mules and sheep, as well as some orchards of things like pistachios and pecans. And so we're able to tell the story not only of Mexico's agricultural past, but its present and indeed the future, because we do have that ability to have with our animals a situation where not only do we have a museum, but we also have what would be very much akin to a zoo.
Not a lot of museum directors are overseeing a farm and animals at the same time. That must have been a fascinating job.
It really was. I learned a lot. We still do wonderful staff, and really got to, you know, I was a city boy from Scottsdale, but I learned about cattle pretty quick. Even had to pull a calf one day. So you learn how to do things. So it was wonderful.
And what brought you interested in the topic of, brought you to be interested in the topic of this book, The New Mexico Borderlands and Warfare During the Era of the Late Spanish Empire?
Well, I'd always been interested in, again, the Spanish and the Apache relationships. And that interest was really brought out. You know, I'm from Arizona, and we lived here now in New Mexico for about 20 years. And that's part of the Borderlands area. And so sort of in the air, if you will, here in Arizona and New Mexico and Texas. And so it's just sort of a natural thing to be around. And because I had sort of a predilection for military history, and then in my museum career, dealing with weapons and armor and things like that from the Spanish period, there was sort of a convergence of all of this. And so that got me interested in Spanish military history along the borderlands. And like I say, I wrote several books, each dealing with mainly the 18th century. And as I was doing normal research, which historians do, I came across, for this particular book, a reference in several contemporary 18th century documents about a so-called uprising of the Mescalero Apaches, in which 56 Spanish troopers were killed. And most of these references were very brief. And when I started to examine things, most of the secondary material really gave short shrift to the events and gave very little detail. And it struck me that, you know, anytime at least 56 guys for the Spanish, you know, only had about 2,000 guys on the whole frontier, this is a really significant loss of manpower. And I figured this had to be more to this story than just the sort of brief references that that I was finding. And as I dug into primary documents about this event, I uncovered, at least for me, for the first time for myself, that there was a plethora, a wide amount of material on this particular event. And then as I looked into the event of the so-called uprising, found that it was much more complex than just sort of a one-off kind of thing. And it actually led to the realization on my part this represented a significant war in and of itself that the Spanish Empire waged against the Mescalero Apaches for a period of about 5 years, and that it was in reality one of the longest and most sustained military efforts that the Spanish had ever waged along the entire frontier, certainly in the 18th century and perhaps even through the 17th, 18th, beginning of the 19th century. So there was much more to this story than I first realized, and that I had seen in other documents. And so I thought that it was a story that deserved to be told.
One of the many things that I think is fascinating about this book is methodologically, it almost feels kind of like a chronological micro history. It takes place over a very short period of time. But in that kind of narrow time frame, you dive extremely deeply into the details of what is going on the ground. Can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to write a book that was fairly short, maybe a decade or so, with a half decade really being kind of the crux of the book? Why you wanted to do that, and what were some of the maybe challenges in writing a book of this nature?
Okay, usually when you write about the history of the Apaches and the Spaniards, conflict is at the heart of their relationship. It always had been and would be for almost the entire 300 or 400 years of time that the Apaches and the Spaniards are aware of each other. And so I was always sort of interested in that. And because of sort of the wide breadth of Apache and Spanish conflict, ranging in an area going from basically the middle of Arizona all the way almost to the Texas Gulf Coast, a very vast area of several thousand miles, the things are happening in one particular area that may not be happening in another particular area. And it's from a strategic point of view, it's very diffuse. It's hard to get a grasp on what's happening all across the frontier at different times and at different periods. What struck me about this particular conflict was that it did occur in a very definable area, both geographically and temporally. And within that area, you know, the Spanish archives, the Spanish are very profuse in their production of documentation on everything. They're ultimate bureaucrats. And while there is much documentation on other warfare and other areas during this period, this particular conflict had a lot of primary documentation. Again, it's almost all from the Spanish point of view. But some of it had references to Apaches, and you're able to see some Apache personalities and some idea of how they saw the situation. Again, reflected from the Spanish point of view, but nevertheless still there. And all of this together, the depth of material, the focusing of the material on space and time, and the ability to look at things from both perspectives was really sort of unique in what I'd seen before. And so it was really kind of exciting to have a readily definable story that was pretty much laid out for you right there.
Well, let's get into the book a bit, and let's start by setting the scene. Tell us about the North American Southwest, the sort of borderland region at the end of the 1780s and the beginning of the 1790s. Who are some of the historical actors who are present? Who has power on the ground at this place at this time?
Okay. The Spanish drive northward to what we now call in America the Spanish borderlands or the Southwestern borderlands. It begins with the conquest of Cortes in the 16th century, and there's a gradual movement northward to take over essentially lucrative mining areas. Very quickly on this, throughout the late 16th, early 17th century, throughout the rest of the 17th century, the Spanish are hitting mining bonanzas in cities, gradually moving northward. Starting out first in Mexico City, but then they move forward into Durango and Zacatecas and later Chihuahua. And all of these places are moving forward north towards the Rio Grande, essentially. At the same time that the Spanish are having these mining bonanzas, one of the ways that they're trying to control the native inhabitants is through forced acculturation through missions. Basically having Catholic priests, Dominican orders, Franciscans, Jesuits, Augustinians, mainly Franciscans and Jesuits, go north and try to gather the Indians together into agricultural settlements and then acculturate them, have them become tax-paying citizens of the Republic. So there's sort of two things going on. There's mining bonanzas and there's missions going on. And because of this, the Spanish move northward is very chaotic. It's not very well planned out. It's from a strategic level. Things are happening. Boom towns are happening. Missions are happening. Some are successful, some aren't. And so you get gradually by the end of the 17th century, a very haphazard northern frontier. In the beginning of the 18th century, it's a little bit of a European history here. The Spanish Habsburg dynasty is replaced by the Spanish Bourbon dynasty in the year 1700. And following that, the Bourbon kings initiate what they're called the Bourbon Reforms. They're trying to bring a bit more order out of chaos, mainly in order to get more money from especially Mexico, and to sort of be able to defend things. Back up here for a quick second. New Spain, which is Mexico mainly, in the 18th century, is the richest country in the world by far. New Spain itself produces probably a quarter, perhaps up to a third, of all the silver that is used in the entire world. Okay, and New Spain is the milch cow of the Spanish Empire. It is the economic basis of which Spain is able to control her vast empire is through Mexican silver and the monies that pours out. And so there's this great need to defend New Spain and the silver production there. Jumping ahead a little bit, in what we call the French and Indian War in the United States, which was a 7 years war in the rest of Europe, Spain joins France late in the conflict, and both France and Spain suffer a humiliating defeat at the hands of Great Britain. This is in 1762, 63, 64. The Spanish lose the island of Cuba and the city of Havana, which is the entrepot, the port from which all the silver goes to from the New World to Spain. In order to get that back, they give the British Florida, and the French give them Louisiana. And so you have this international scene happening. As a result of this loss in the war, King Carlos III of Spain realizes that there's going to be another war eventually with Great Britain, which there will be in the 1770s and 80s, the War of the American Revolution. And Spain will have to fight Britain again. And so these Bourbon reforms are designed to get military efficiency and financial stability prior to this next great war. As part of these reforms along the northern frontier of New Spain, what's now Mexico, the crown comes up with the idea of establishing a defensive line, presidios of the line, presidios or forts. And along this line, they will introduce a combined military command that will have control over all the military forces, essentially from California to Louisiana and all the area in between. Beginning in the mid-1760s through the 1770s, the Spanish will establish what's called the line of presidios. Presidios, again, are fort and its garrisons that will follow the course of the Rio Grande and a line of 30 degrees north latitude, which amazingly, if you look at the map, is the present international boundary. This is the area that Spain actually controls, although there are some fingers going north, such as at San Antonio, Texas, or in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, New Mexico. But for the most part, the frontier lies along what is now the international border. The Spanish recognized very quickly on that the interior provinces, as this northern frontier is called, the interior provinces of New Spain, is a potential area for invasion from either first the French, later the British, and later the Americans, for an attack on the Mexican silver mines in a bit farther south, Durango, Zacatecas, etc., which are vulnerable. And of course, silver is the most important thing that the Spanish have. So the Spanish are trying to defend this area to the best of their abilities in case there would be such an attack. And it's interesting to note that in 1846, when the Mexican-American War starts, the Americans, the United States, attacks the northern frontier, especially in a way the Spaniards had thought that the British or the French or the Americans would do 40 years earlier, which is interesting to see that their suspicions were correct. Within this area, along the northern frontier, the major problem the Spaniards have is not Europeans, but independent indigenous peoples who are attacking Spanish settlements and raiding for livestock, slaves, that type of thing. The most numerous and the most bothersome from the Spanish point of view are the Apaches. And the Apaches range in autonomous bands, again, basically from central Mexico or central Arizona, all the way across eastern Arizona, central Arizona, eastern Arizona, all of New Mexico, and most of Texas, even going up into Colorado and places like that. The Apaches are first and foremost raiders, assassins. They are not a warrior people per se, They do not have warrior societies like other indigenous peoples like the Cheyenne or the Sioux or the Comanche. However, they're very bothersome to the Spanish in that the Apaches had been for centuries raiding the sedentary peoples, indigenous peoples of the region, such as the Puebloan peoples of New Mexico and the Oodham peoples of Arizona, the Pima and Papago, as we're called. And when the Spanish come in and basically take over these indigenous peoples, the Apaches begin to raid the Spanish just as well. The attacks of the Apaches along the interior provinces do not really threaten Spain's hold on it, but they do divert resources, military and financial, that probably could be used better elsewhere. So from the imperial point of view, the Spanish want to find the quickest, cheapest, and easiest way to take care of the Apaches, to get them to be quiet. There's a great line that Bill Cosby had in his book called Fatherhood. We talked about parents are not interested in justice. They're interested in quiet. Well, along the northern frontier, the Spanish are not interested in justice. They're interested in quiet. They want the Apaches to settle down. The question is, how are you going to get them to settle down? Well, for about 20 years, beginning in the 1770s and lasting through the 1790s, the Spanish have what I call the confusion of power. The Spanish have the ability to crush the Apaches if they want to, militarily. The question is, what is the reason to compel them to do so? Well, they don't really have one, especially if they're looking to retrench, especially if they're looking to economize on their forces. So what they come up with is an old Roman tactic, which is divide and conquer, the idea of the mailed fist within the velvet glove. The Spanish will begin to fluctuate between attempts to destroy the Apaches militarily or to reach some accommodation with them to settle them down on what are essentially reservations and acculturate them to the point where they're no longer bothersome. Beginning in the 1770s, there will be, again, this fluctuation. The interior provinces are placed under a separate military commander. First is a man named Hugo O'Connor, who is one of the Irish wild geese, who is a religious and political exile from Ireland, who joins the Spanish army, rises very far. His uncle is Alejandro O'Reilly, one of the premier Spanish officers of the 18th century. And O'Connor is given the title of a commandant inspector of the interior provinces. He is ordered to basically form the Presidio Line, which he does between 1774 and 1776. At the same time, he wages two massive campaigns against the Apaches, again, along the entire frontier, which are fairly successful. However, in 1777, the Spanish decide to upgrade interior provinces into what's called a Comandancia General, the Comandancia General de las Provincias Internas. O'Connor is replaced by a Commandant General. He had been Commandant Inspector. Now there's a Commandant General by the name of Teodoro de Croix, known as the Caballero de Croix. He is a Fleming, or what we call a Belgian, very well connected in the Spanish court. And he's the ultimate bureaucrat, where O'Connor had been a warrior. Croix was much more of a bureaucrat. He halts the aggressive actions that O'Connor had engaged in and tries accommodation. He tries to settle the Apaches in at least a few of them, in what are known as establecimientos, later called establecimientos. It means a peace establishment. It's essentially a reservation. The idea is that the Apaches will come to reside outside of Spanish presidios, Spanish forts. They will be given a monthly dole of beef and sugar and cigars and tobacco, and encouraged by the Spaniards to adopt a less violent lifestyle. Unfortunately for Croy, his idea doesn't work. The Apaches are very diverse people. We'll talk about here in just a moment. And so Croy's attempts at peace fail. When he leaves in 1784-85, there is an attempt by a man by the name Bernardo de Galvez, who is the new viceroy of Spain, or of New Spain, I should say, of Mexico, to institute, he thinks the interior provinces are too big, and so he breaks them in half. He puts a commandant general in the east and a commandant general in the west. And he hopes that they'll work together to help crush the Apaches. Unfortunately, Galvez dies very soon thereafter. And the commandant generals of the east and the west, for about the next 10 years, will begin to feud with each other and have different policies. Usually, those in the west will favor accommodation, while those in the east will favor crushing, the mill fist and the velvet glove. The result is that you have this confusion of power. Spaniards in one part of the interior provinces are trying peace, in the other part, they're trying war. The Apaches will play this off very well. They'll go from one side to the other, depending what the local situation is. And the result is that there is not any peace. There's a little bit here and a little bit there, but then it's not uniform. Beginning in 1790, an important guy who I read about in the book, his name is Pedro de Nava. He will become the new commandant general. And by 1792, he is, 1793, he becomes the commandant general of the entire frontier. The Spanish, once again, have a single commander over their military frontier. And this is key, because Nava will take the best of both worlds and basically begin to try to have the Apaches settle down in the reservations, establecimientos. But on the same time, he warns them that, okay, here's the establecimientos, here's the reservation, we will feed you, we'll take care of you, we'll even use you as auxiliaries to help us fight other Indians, so you, the Apaches' native proclivity to violence will be tapped. However, if you push us too far, if you get a little too noisy, a little too rambunctious, we'll hunt you all down and we'll kill you all. And as an emphasis of that, Nava accelerates an old Spanish practice of deporting Apaches captured in battle, prisoners of war, from the frontier to Cuba, where they will be placed in this essentially slave labor to work on the fortifications at Havana and other places. And even after this, it's supposed to be for 10 years, if the Apaches survive that 10 years, they'll never be allowed to go back to the frontier. So the Spanish begin to use a very stark choice to all of the Apaches. And this is the situation that begins when the book begins in about 1795. Beginning in the late 1780s, there had been the attempts to have the establecimiento de paz for various Apaches. I'm going to stop now for a moment and talk about the Apaches.
Yes, of course.
The Apaches are, there are no Apaches, first of all. It's an outside term given to them by Puebloan people, Zuni people, possibly means enemy. Apaches have no sense of either pan-Indianism or pan-Apacheism, I could make up a word. They are atomistic to an extraordinarily small degree. Within Apache society, every head of household, every male head of household, is essentially an autonomous being, and his family is with him. He can do what he wants, when he wants, and how he wants, regardless of any larger social or political grouping. These heads of household are usually heads of what the Spanish will call rancherias. Rancheria is mainly means an encampment, you know, a group of tents, if you will. But it actually comes to mean an extended family. That is the primary identification among all the Apaches, is their rancheria first. Okay? They will not necessarily see themselves as part of a larger band or tribe. Now, outsiders, the Spanish will fall into this, later the Americans, the Mexicans as well, We'll try to, because, you know, we're Western people, and we like to have order, and so we must classify everything. And so they group the Apaches into what they regard as tribes. So you have in the far west, you have the Tonto, or what we now call the White Mountain Apaches of Arizona. To their south and east, you have the Chiricahua people, which have several distinct bands. Then sort of in the middle, in what is now New Mexico and West Texas, you have the Mescalero people. And then farther east, you have the Lipan and the Jicarilla Apaches. Okay? And they're more buffalo people, living on the Llano Estacado. Mescaleros, which we deal with in this book, are in a unique biological zone, where the Apaches to the west, the White Mountain, the Tonto, the Chiricahua, are mainly mountain people. They grow their own food to a certain extent, a little bit less than subsistence. They subsist on game and wild fruits and grains. To the farther east, the Lipan, the Jicarilla, they are buffalo people. They are on the southern Great Plains. They hunt buffalo. That is their primary source, just like the Comanche and the Cheyenne and the Sioux. They're sort of the traditional Hollywood view of Indians. In the middle are the Mescaleros. The Mescaleros live along the Rio Grande in the mountains of what is now Central New Mexico, all the way down to the Big Bend of the Rio Grande in what is now West Texas. And they live in a transitional zone. They live in an area that allows them to go out onto the Buffalo Plains and hunt, like their Lipan and Jicarilla cousins. But they're also mountain people, in that they can go back to the mountains of the Sacramento Mountains of Central New Mexico, Guadalupe Mountains of West Texas, and live closer to the lifestyle that the Chiricahua and White Mountain Apaches have. So they're, to a certain extent, get the both of best worlds. So within Mescalero society, like Apache society as a whole, these larger groupings that the outsiders have are not necessarily how they see themselves, meaning the Apaches. So, for example, the Spanish will give to the Apaches in central New Mexico, West Texas, the title of Mescalero, which means mezcal eaters. Mezcal is a form of yucca that it's a plant here, which is in the Southwest, and has an edible root, and you can harvest it certain times and it will provide sustenance. And so the Spanish identify them as mezcal eaters, mescalero. However, amongst the mescaleros themselves, there's at least four or five different groupings. They see the people, there's names that mean the people against the mountains, the peoples near the plain, the peoples near the water. And so, again, they don't see themselves as outsiders do, and they do not have any type of political organization to speak of. Again, any independent head of a rancheria can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. This is especially confusing and confounding to the Spanish, because one of the best things that Apaches do, and Mescaleros especially, is raid. And they raid for horses, they raid for cattle, they raid for slaves. They've been doing this for centuries before the Spanish came, against the Pueblo and other peoples. Again, when the Spanish come, they simply pick up and have a new person to go after. For the Spaniards, the idea of this raiding is extremely confusing, because they'll attempt over and over and over and over again to make peace with a group of Mescalero or Apache people that they think speaks for a larger group, speaks for a tribe, or speaks for a band. And there's treaty after treaty after treaty after treaty, all of which are broken by the Apaches. Why? Because the guy who is talking and making peace with the Spaniards, and the Spaniards never figure this out, is only talking for himself. He has no control over anybody else. And so if a guy, Apache family leader, was not there and didn't sign the peace treaty, he has no problem with going out and continuing raiding. And the Spanish kind of go to the guy they signed the peace treaty with and say, wait a minute, you said you were going to control this guy. And he can't. So you have this attempt by the Spanish, the Americans will do the same thing, the Mexicans will do the same thing, to negotiate as they would with a nation state with an indigenous people who have no political organization that's worth anything to negotiate with. And so this is the basic conundrum the Spanish have with the Apaches. I'm not talking too long on this.
No, not at all.
So, second thing about the Apaches. The Apaches have a very distinct version or vision, I should say, of warfare. Again, they are not a warrior society in the way that we think of. No self-respecting Apache is going to go out and fight to the death in a blaze of glory if he can help it. Apaches do not look at warfare that way. They look at warfare as in two phrases. One is for taking things from the enemy, which is mainly livestock or, again, people, slaves, or goods. And the other is taking life from the enemy. Taking life from the enemy is to go out and kill somebody. Why do the Apaches want to go out and kill somebody? Well, most Apaches don't. They want to go out there and get stuff. They get stuff that will help them in, you know, horses that will give them prestige, help them get a wife, help them become a bigger man in society, that type of thing. They're not really interested in killing anybody. However, when you go out, especially among the Spaniards, when you start stealing their horses, sometimes they get angry and they shoot at you and they kill you. But for the Apaches, this becomes a cultural imperative to avenge the death of one of their own, whether it's killed by an outsider or by another Apache. There must be what the Italians would call vendetta. There must be blood for blood. However, for the Apaches, the taking of a life or blood for blood is not necessarily confined to the person or the group that inflicted the casualty on them. So, for example, if a Spanish soldier or settler in this the city of El Paso, let's say, shoots and kills an Apache trying to steal his horse, Apaches will demand blood for blood. However, they don't necessarily go after the guy who did it, or even the community who did it. So these Apaches might be, a month or two later, going around, and let's say they're near Albuquerque, New Mexico, 250 miles from El Paso. Well, they'll kill a Spaniard, this first Spaniard that they see. And to them, that will satisfy the blood for blood, even though the guy that they killed in Albuquerque had nothing to do with what happened with the Apache who was killed in El Paso. For the Apaches, the idea of personal responsibility is absolutely foreign. What matters to them is that the other must suffer. Okay? So if a Spaniard kills an Apache, the Apache, that group of Apaches, will seek vengeance against any other Spaniard that they happen to come across, because that's the other. Okay? It doesn't matter. They're not looking in justice. They're looking to balance that blood. Well, this is the nature of warfare among the Apache peoples with the Spanish. Somebody's killed. The Apaches feel they got to go out and kill somebody else. But they won't kill somebody in this area. They'll kill somebody in that area. So for the Spaniards, it looks like, my God, these Apaches are going all over the place, killing people without any, you know, pattern. They're striking where they want against anybody that they want. How are we going to contain this? Well, again, the cheapest, easiest, quickest way to do it, eventually Pedro de Nava comes up with the idea, again, the velvet glove and the mailed fist. We will ask them to settle down. We will give them incentives to settle down, to stay near the presidios. We'll try to regulate their behavior as much as we can. We'll try to not necessarily turn them into Christians, which many of the Spanish priests in the area are vehemently opposed to the idea that they're not going to try to turn them into Catholics, Christians. But again, the Spanish military wants quiet. And what the Spanish are attempting to do throughout the northern frontier, throughout the 18th century, is to use a we would call it I'll call it anachronism. They're attempting to apply what the United States and the Soviet Union agreed to in the 20th century. They are looking for deterrence. The Spanish are not necessarily looking to conquer the Apaches. They're not necessarily looking to convert them to Christianity. They're looking to deter them to such a level that the violence is manageable. Okay? And this is why the whole idea of the Establecimiento de Paz, getting them near a reservation, calming them down, regulating the violence, keeping it at a low level, this has become official Spanish policy. So this is what's happening in the 1770s, 80s, and 90s. And again, by about 1792, 3, 4, and 5, there are about 11 different reservations scattered throughout the interior provinces. There are about 2,500, 2,000 Apaches. Spanish will call them Apaches de Paz, peaceful Apaches, versus Apaches de Guerra, Apaches of War. There may be 10 or 15,000 Apaches all told. So the Spanish maybe have a fifth of them somewhat acculturated or under control, or at least they think. And that's where the story of the Mescalero uprising begins.
So let's talk about that uprising then. You did a great job of setting the scene, kind of putting all the pieces in place, but what sparks this conflict? What are the immediate origins of this uprising?
Well, the immediate origins are the Mescaleros, and a good number of them were at there have been a couple, at least two, maybe three, establishmentos, reservations, one outside of El Paso, what would now be El Paso, Texas, or Juarez, Chihuahua, right across the border from El Paso. And a little farther down, about 40 miles down, there was another place called San Elisario, still San Elisario, Texas. There was a reservation there. And then farther south to where Presidio, Texas is now, kind of Ojinaga, Mexico, there's also a third Mescalero reservation. A fair number of Mescaleros are there and stay, you know, regularly. Others from the hinterland will come in every now and then to get a beef or cigars. There's a low level of violence or some, you know, cattle theft, horse theft, that kind of thing. A random killing every now and then. But things are fairly calm. Then about 1793-94, something absolutely nothing to deal with the frontier affects the frontier. Like most imperial powers, Spain has holdings across the world. Spain at the time is a major military power, major imperial power. And in 1793, Spain will go to war with revolutionary France, the beginning of the French Revolution. And the Spaniards will go to war for about 2 years. It's called the War of the Pyrenees with revolutionary France. And at that time, in order to save money and to divert it to imperial defense, the Spanish begin to divert resources from what they consider extraneous things, such as the establecimientos for the Apaches. And so they begin to tell the Apaches, look, we're not going to give you as much food as we were before, and we're really not going to give you very much at all. You can go out into the hinterland and support yourself. We're still going to expect you to live the way we want you to live and not raid, not attack our settlements. So there's a diminution of a diminution of support at the frontier. Other Apaches, such as the Chiricahua and some of the Lipans, don't really resent it. But for some reason, the Mescaleros do, or at least a large number of them do, more so than others. Beginning about 1795, after about a year of this, you know, scanty or shrinkage of support, the Mescaleros, or at least a large number of them, all of the Apaches at the establecimientos, there always will be a split. There always be some that are on the Spanish side. There always be some that are totally against the Spanish, and there'll be a large number in between who will be. If things are looking good, they'll stay on the Spanish side. If things look bad, they'll go to the warrior side or the anti-Spanish side. There's always a mix of Apaches coming and going. So it's very hard for the Spanish to identify who's who in any particular specificity. So then in 1795, it appears that a large group of Apaches, probably about 300 or 400 of them, were going to launch a raid into Spanish territory, not along the frontier, but they were going to go deeper into Spanish territory, and you know, go on a big cattle raid, a big horse raid. Well, they're waiting basically in the area of what's known as the Pittman Mountains of West Texas, on the border between Texas and Mexico. There's a large grouping of them there. They're having ceremonial things. They've sent out a couple small parties. And totally by accident, on August 9th, one group of Spanish soldiers, about 50 men, stumbles upon the Mescaleros. And the Mescaleros see him coming and figure, you know, God, if they see us here, you know, we're in trouble. What do we do? And I said, the bellicose ones get the upper hand. And so they ambush the Spanish and they kill about half of them. Well, 3 days later, another Spanish patrol from another area coming from farther east, the same thing happens. They're patrolling their areas. They're supposed to. They stumble upon the Mescaleros. And again, another 25 or so Spanish troopers are killed. So in both of these ambushes, about 56 Spaniards are killed. Well, to the Spanish, this is a total surprise. Wait a minute, what's going on? We thought the Apaches, the Mescaleros, we know, so we've been just talking to some. You know, we didn't expect this at all. And for the Mescaleros, the thing, it seems to have been a surprise too. They were planning on attacking these Spanish patrols. They just happened to stumble upon them. And then again, they get the better of them. After they defeat the Spanish, they get bunches of horses and guns, and they capture the Spaniard supply train. So they're all happy. They got all kinds of stuff. And they go back home thinking, okay, well, we don't need to go into central Mexico to raid stuff. We'll just take what we got from this couple of Spanish patrols. Well, from the Spanish point of view, this attack is unpardonable. Here were Apaches at peace with us, and for no reason at all, they attacked our folks. And they did. The Mescalero is the one who started it. Okay. Well, the Commandant General of the Interior Provinces, Pedro de Nava, after sort of a first, you know, shock of what's going on, basically decides that we're not going to have this anymore. Because he realizes that the Mescalero, sort of being in the middle of the interior provinces, if they're allowed to get away with this aggression, and the Lapans farther to the east might do the same, and the Chiricahuas farther to the west might do the same. So he decides to make a strategic decision that they are going to crush the Mescaleros, and that this needs to be a signal to all the Apaches, basically, do not mess with us. And to make a long story short, he basically will organize his forces on a very, very skillful level. He will begin to launch punitive expeditions, not just to stop the Mescaleros from coming into Spanish territory, but going into their homelands, going across the Rio Grande, attacking them in their own lands. And he will organize his forces in such a way that the Spanish will continue to launch strikes against the Mescaleros wherever they can find them, all along basically from what would now be central to New Mexico to the Big Bend country of West Texas, very large area. Constant expeditions, especially expeditions in the winter time, because the Mescaleros usually, like most indigenous people, don't fight in the winter, right? Winters are harsh. They'll go and they'll hunt buffalo in the late fall. They'll get, you know, tons and tons of buffalo meat, all the stuff that they need, and then retreat into the mountains and have enough in their larder to last them till spring. Well, Pedro de Nava and his officers, especially the guy by the name of Colonel Antonio Cordero, very aware of Apache lifestyles, Mescalero lifestyles, begin to launch these attacks in the wintertime or at the time when the Mescaleros are trying to go to the buffalo hunts. So that basically the Spanish destroy their enemy's commissariat. They basically make it impossible for the Mescaleros to feed themselves. And after about 4.5 years of constant attacks into their own homeland, destroying their ability to feed themselves. Mescaleros sue for peace. There may be approximately 5,000 Mescaleros at the beginning of the war. At least 750 of them are killed, and probably more. So you're looking at a casualty rate of somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% of the entire population. Absolutely brutal, and absolutely totally victorious from the Spanish point of view.
And there are a few points in the story that you tell where global events have important implications for the war between the Spanish Empire and the Mescalero Apache people. And one that jumps to mind immediately is the capture of Puerto España. And that's just one example of many, which reverberates throughout Mexico. So can you talk a little bit about this, how this conflict was kind of nestled into larger global imperial conflicts at the end of the 18th century?
Sure. The problem the Spanish have, again, is, again, they are an imperial power. And, again, we talked about how at the beginning of the war may have been triggered by Spain's need for more money and more resources in fighting in revolutionary France in 1793 and 94. Well, almost immediately after the Spanish were defeated by revolutionary France, the Spanish will switch sides and join France against Great Britain. So in 1796 and 97, Spain goes to war with Great Britain, which is disastrous for Spain. Again, there's the need for retrenchment and money and things like that. In this later period, meaning about 1796, which is really the sort of the second year that Commandant General Pedro de Nava was going to launch his strikes against the Mescaleros, he begins to get frantic reports from the viceroy in New Spain, a guy by the name of the Marquis de Brantaforte, that the British are planning to attack Mexico, again, to seize the silver. And there are indications, the Spanish have spies in, of all places, Baltimore, Maryland. A spy in Baltimore, Maryland picks up a report that 10,000 British troops are going to be sent across Canada and coming down the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, attack Spanish posts in what is now Louisiana and Illinois, and then divert towards the interior provinces. There's also a report the Spanish has spies in Asia that a British expeditionary force from India is going to attack Spanish California. And so in the midst of trying to focus on the Mescaleros, Commandant General Pedro de Nava is told by his superiors, you need to send some of your boys to make sure the California is secure. You need to send some more of your boys eastward towards Louisiana to make sure there's no British coming down there. Well, this all sounds rather fanciful to us, you know, knowing what we know and knowing the how far it is from Canada to New Mexico and the difficulties that would entail. But in reality, the British actually did have contingency plans to sail down the Missouri, to sail down the Mississippi from Canada, and to attack Spanish holdings along the frontier as diversionary attacks. Okay, so it's not the Spanish were right. The British were planning things like that. The British didn't do it, but how do you know at the time? So in 1796 and 97 especially, peace will be made a little bit later with Great Britain. Spain will sue for peace. But at the time, these imperial entanglements are happening. And one of the reasons the Spanish think that the British might attack the interior provinces is that in 1797, the British send out, the Britannia rolls away, the British have great maritime resources. The British attack out of the blue the island of Trinidad and the Spanish garrison and small Spanish fleet, four ships of the line, that were in what is called Puerto España, Port of Spain, in Trinidad. Just out of the blue, the Spanish have no idea that the guys in Trinidad don't even know they're at war yet. And all of a sudden, here comes this British expeditionary force of about 15,000 guys, including, you know, about a dozen ships of the line, totally outnumbers the Spanish. The Spanish try to deny their ships to the British and set them on fire. one doesn't catch on fire and the British captured. The Spanish governor of Trinidad doesn't know what to do. The British land unopposed, seize the island bloodlessly. This particular British attack reverberates throughout the Spanish Empire. It's one of the reasons I chose it for the book, in that basically the Spanish realize that the British can strike them anywhere. They can strike the Spanish Empire anywhere at any time. In reality, the Spanish will not be able to do a darn thing about it. So this makes the idea that the British might attack the northern frontier or Mexico much, much, much more real to the Spanish in the military plans.
So to kind of come to the end of the story, what are the long-term implications of this conflict, both for the Apaches themselves and for the Spanish Empire?
Well, for the Spanish, for the Apaches themselves, the Mescaleros especially, all the consequences are bad. again, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% of the entire population is either killed, captured, or deported to Cuba, never to be seen again. So the Mescaleros learn a very, very hard lesson. You know, don't mess with the Spaniards. And so while there will essentially be a return to the establishmentos by the Mescaleros, there'll be essentially a status quo antebellum, a very, very harsh lesson has been learned, one that will temper a Mescalero resistance for the remainder of the Spanish period. Really, the Mescaleros won't mess with anybody else until the Americans come in the 1840s and 50s. For other Apaches, the Chiricahuas to the west, the Lipans to the east, there's an object lesson here. Is that, oh my God, these Spaniards can, if they really want to, come after us with everything they've got and, you know, put us in a world of hurt. And the result will be, in the short term, that there will be a period of relative peace beginning about 1800, and lasting until about 1820 throughout the northern frontier, especially among the Apaches. The Apaches de Paz will continue to more or less accept the bargain they had with the Spaniards, that we will not go crazy with our attacks, you know, as long as you feed us and take care of us. And there begins to be, by about 1810, 1815, 1820, a gradual acculturation of the Apaches along the frontier. And this is where the tragedy comes in. If the Spanish Empire had lasted another 10 or 20 years, maybe another generation, the Apaches probably would have been acculturated and become what the Spaniards wanted them to, an indigenous people within the empire. However, it didn't turn out that way. And in 1821, Mexico gains independence from Spain. The Apaches and the Mescaleros, especially, don't really understand the change in government. You know, they're still dealing with the same guys who were one day they were called Spaniards, now they're called Mexicans. Okay, fine. However, the Mexican Republic, the Mexican Empire, the Mexican Republic in the 1820s and 30s is chaotic. Mexico is, her independence is much, much different than the United States. Basically, in Mexico, what happens is the royalists win. The patriots don't win. Okay, imagine if George Washington had been captured and executed, and then Lord Cornwallis, after controlling all of the United States, there had been a revolution in Britain, and he decides to name himself Emperor of the British Empire, or of the 13 colonies. That's essentially what happens in Mexico. In 1821, there's a reactionary revolt in Spain. And so while the royalist cause, the conservative cause in Mexico, won the War of Independence, they declare independence from a temporarily liberal Spain. And once they had independence, they don't go back. The result is that the social problems that plagued Mexico, and still do plague Mexico, were never solved. And so in Mexico, what happens is you begin to get a Praetorian tradition where generals become the most powerful political entities, and you have a series of coups d'etats, they're called golpe de estado in Spanish, where generals mostly, after a couple of years, will, you know, launch a rebellion against the central government. This happens over and over and over and over again in Mexico between 1821 and the 1840s and 50s. The result for our story is that the chaos among the central government in Mexico absolutely destroys the system of the establecimientos. There's no longer any money. There's no longer money for soldiers, no longer money for the presidios, let alone money for the beef and sugar given to the Apaches. Tragically, the Apaches try to keep going. They like the system. At least until 1830, they try to work with Mexicans to continue the system. But the central government simply can't sustain it for a variety of reasons. And so in 1831, 1832, the Apaches begin to abandon the establecimientos and return to their own traditional ways of raiding and violence. And so from that 1830 to the coming of the Americans to the 1850s, the Apaches, even though they remembered the establecimientos of the Spanish and wanted to have that relationship, Mexico simply can't sustain it. They return to violence, they return to raiding, they return to warfare. And when the Americans come in the 1850s, they will find the Spanish are only partially, or excuse me, the Apaches are only partially acculturated, that they're still extremely violent. And the tragedy is that beginning in 1846, 1848, the Americans in the next 40 years will have to do the exact same thing that the Spaniards did in the late 18th century, to go to war with the Apaches, establish the velvet glove in the mailed fist, eventually put them on reservations. And so it's a great tragedy, I think, if you see that history can repeat itself with great tragic events. Again, the lessons learned by the Spaniards will have to be relearned by the Americans, and there will be another 50 years of violence and forced acculturation, which is, if you look at it from a long point of view, is really, again, a great tragedy.
So you sort of just addressed this question a second ago, but maybe to put a finer point on it, if there's one takeaway that you hope readers come away from this book understanding, what might that be?
Well, I'd hope that, first of all, they learn a couple things. One is the horrors of war. There's a couple instances I'm able to point out that really show how terrible war is, and not just in terms of physical violence, but sort of cultural and psychological as well. There's a great a story where the Spanish in midwinter attack a group of about 75 to 100 mescaleros, and mostly mescaleros, get away. They're able to escape the Spaniards, but the Spanish are able to destroy everything they've got. They burn their teepees, their lodges. They kill all their horses. They get all their weapons. They've got they destroy like 2 tons worth of buffalo meat that was going to sustain them over the winter. And these people are out on the Llano Estacado, out in the great estate plains of the southern plains of the United States, on their own, afoot, with no weapons. What happened to those people? Well, I don't know, and the records don't say. But I hope, as an example of the horrors of war, that the readers would say for a moment, said, what did happen to those poor people? They were out there in the middle of nowhere, with nothing, in the middle of winter. What do you do? What happened to them? Probably they all died of exposure. Maybe some of them maybe were able to make it to other bands, but whatever happened, it wasn't good. So that's one of the instances where I think the nature of war on our individual, their person, their psyche, is very real. That's one thing. The second I hope that people see is, there is a, especially for those living in the Southwest, many of the events that took place in this war are readily identifiable. There's still, for example, there's a big battle at a place called Hueco Tanks in West Texas. There's a state park there now. There are places that the people in the Southwest and Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, visitors from the rest of the country can go and realize that there was, a couple hundred years ago, there was some really important history going here, some really, really violent history going here. And I hope people realize that history is all around them, that, it's not always something that is, far removed. It's not, outside the gates of Moscow. It's in your own backyard.
And Mark, now that you are retired from your museum work, and now that this book has been out and been winning awards for the last couple of years, can you give us a preview of what you're working on next, what you're working on now?
Well, okay. Well, a couple things. I'm actually working on a second biography, a more detailed biography of Hugo O'Connor, the first Commandant Inspector of the Interior Provinces. Again, sort of a fascinating guy who fights for the... He's in Ireland because he's a Catholic. He has to leave his family and his home. He goes to join the army in Spain. He fights in the Seven Years' War. Ends up sent to, becomes the governor of Texas. Then, again, is in charge against the Apaches. And ends up dying in the province of Yucatan, as the governor of Yucatan in Mexico in 1779. So we're kind of a biography of him. I'm also working on a more detailed and more episodic history of the Spanish military on the northern frontier, sort of going from decade to decade, from about 1700 to 1820, and each chapter having a story that is more human, a more personal story of individuals and events, sort of showing the progression of the history from the viewpoint of those who actually experienced.
Mark Santiago is the now very recently former director of the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and is the author of A Bad Peace and a Good War. A Bad Peace and a Good War, Spain and the Mescalero Apache Uprising of 1795 to 1799, which came out with the University of Oklahoma Press in 2018, and last year won the Robert M. Utley Award in Military History of the Frontier and West from the Western History Association. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Mark.
Thank you, Steve. I very much appreciate it.